timber. But I think the Southeast Village corporations are all in a similar situation where they have a limited amount of land, unlike other village corporations. And the major perception of that land is economic development. And whether or not any of the village corporations would be willing to put that land in a land bank, time will tell. But if we're looking at economic development, and what he had stated earlier, that the land bank would be for land which would not go, which would have no economic value, then there is no land in Southeast that would go in the land bank. But I think what the village corporations are going to have to do is decide, divide it up, as Bart said, okay, what land will be used for private interest, say future land distributions, which Shaanxi is considering. What land of our 23,000 acres will be for commercial development, and what land will be for timber development, and then what land will be for communal use only. But I think the village corporations are going to have to decide that on their own.
Rosita?
I'm going to try to give a stab at answering Monroe's question over here. First of all, I think we have to deal with a couple of premises and sometimes I think maybe misconceptions about Native societies. And one is that there is this assumption that there wasn't individual property. From my knowledge, individual property, individual rights has always been a characteristic of Native societies, but we tend to focus only on the communal aspect. And then the other issue is that there are always, Native societies were never egalitarian societies, and so there were always rich people and always poor people, whether they were called chiefs or meliks or what. And so there was never, an equal distribution of resources or land among Native people. But to protect that, that communal aspect, that common use requires that you have land, that you utilize in common, and utilization of the land creates social encumbrances from the user. It creates a bond, an obligation to someone else, whether it's a redistribution of the resource or a service, rendered by the one who's the recipient of a resource. So you have to have some common use of land. And I think your question is really interesting. It might be a way to, to satisfy both individual rights as well as communal rights.
Tony Strong?
Oh, excuse me. The other issue that I wanted to bring out, though, is that I think Native communities are doing very well, or they're attempting to do very well, to try to manage those, the need to protect subsistence, but also the very need to have economic development. And in that case, whether it's their lands or other people's lands, what I think the focus has been on environmental protection or things like that.
Yeah, Tony?
Thank you. I'm gonna try to address Monroe's issue that he rose as well. Are allocating or giving subsurface rights to individuals, breaking up the subsurface rights and giving to individuals. He asked if there was going to be a concern, and my immediate reaction was sort of a blank. I didn't know what kind of concern I'd have, but when I think of it in terms of going back to my village, some of the shareholders of the corporation have been given subsurface rights to lands right near the village, but they live down in Los Angeles, or they live in Seattle, or wherever. They've been given a fee simple title, although to a lesser estate than full title, but what's to say that they won't sell that to somebody else, to a company that has discovered that there was some iron ore that's real important, or some other mineral that's real important to a company, and to the company's resource development company. they go ahead and buy that land. They have a right to go ahead and develop that resource. But I'm living in Klokwan. I don't want that. I don't necessarily want my environment destroyed for its subsistence purposes or just for the lifestyle. For whatever reason, I don't want it developed. But I can't. What right do I have to stop that person or that company from developing that subsurface estate? I mean, he does have some right that's enforceable in court to go ahead and develop it. I can't absolutely prohibit it. I could put perhaps some restrictions on it through my tribal government or whatever local government I'm using. But it does present some real difficulties in terms of how do you maintain the control over the development of it then? So that's, you know, that's one of my first thing that came to my mind on it.
Thanks, Tony. Bart?
Monroe, it kind of points out the issue of yes, you could, even in the situation where land had that the use was allocated, there was personality even in tribes, that you could have exclusive use rights, and you know that. The point that Tony points out, it kind of hooks in with destiny self-determination, this issue that why don't you let the natives decide themselves what they want to do? And if it's a choice of all of those people who are there and they make that conscious choice to do it, well, that's fine. The problem is that the kind of groups that we have that are set up, and you know very well with the one that we're familiar with, I have regional shareholders who are not from my area. We have an arbitrary, as a matter of fact, those who are from my area who are actually traditionally there are in the minority. The people who are in my area are from other places. Now that's fine, and that only affects us in the one large urban area. But if you allow stock alienation, that will occur in other areas only much more adversely, where the absentee landlord is, you know, that affects the other people. You know, it may be the larger corporation or individual shareholders or limited partnerships elsewhere. So that's where you get into the problem where it's a conscious choice, but that's where you get the true conflict.
Rosemarie?
Just rang a bell what you said. Why not let the natives decide for themselves? I come from a village that has 206 shareholders. They're also shareholders of a regional corporation. When we first started in 1973, there was no word to describe shares in our native language. There was no word to describe corporation. How do you explain to people that do not speak English very well what shares and corporation and a piece of paper means? And I think, you know, let the natives decide for themselves. A lot of the older people still do not understand what that piece of paper means. Can they make that decision?
Drew Hageman.
Just to speak to that issue, I think that sometimes when we look at and we've reviewed some options yesterday, or some ideas, some alternative structural forms to the for-profit corporation as a way of protecting the land. We looked at cooperatives and various forms of nonprofit organizations. I think that in some ways, Rosemarie, what you're raising, I think, is an issue that and it may be an obvious one, but I'll raise it anyway. Not only are we talking about structural forms or ways to protect the land, I think part and parcel of that is not only a concern for will those forms be congruent with values, the values of the people for which that structure is supposed to serve, but I think we're also raising the issue of the capacity, and I don't mean just in terms of skills of native managers, but the capacity of any management group to make those structural forms do what it is that we want them to do. When we look at Land Bank or David Case's nightmare, when we look at state chartered nonprofits or cooperatives, when we look at adjustments to present for-profit corporations or the existing for-profit corporations, I think those structures demand varying kinds or varying levels of management skills, sophisticated approaches, and I'm really concerned that we may find a structural form that may, at least on the at the outset, appear to serve us well in terms of protecting the land, but we don't know how to make it work. and we don't have the skills to make it work. And so we're going to fail, and it will appear that it's native people who are failing. Well, it's not native people who are failing, it's the structural form that we've adopted.
Well, maybe we could, we've talked about the possibility of assignment of individual parcels of land to shareholders, and Dolly told us that had been done by her corporation. I don't think it's been done by many others. Perhaps one reason is that the possibility for doing so is limited in many other places. But no. Well, I'd be interested in knowing what the.
I drew up the, in part, the plan, and there's two or three other places where the home site provisions have been attempted to be implemented. There are technical difficulties with identifying the land and equalizing value that, and Bristol Bay has done it, I think, in part.
Two of the villages in the region have done a home site program.
Two in Bristol Bay.
Yeah, that's.
It's functional, though.
Those are just the Milka.
Those are the 1.5 acre home site lots, are they?
What about the Seldovia? That's not.
I'm not certain the Anilka ones are taken advantage of because of the tax consequences.
But what about, aside from Anilka, haven't there been other subdivisions?
Distributions. I think that there have been of monies and perhaps lands, but there have been partial liquidations to provide for distributions of money that I'm aware of, that I've heard of through the grapevine.
But yeah. It might be useful for the commission to get a survey of that.
Yeah, Dolly, and then Roland.
Just one thing real quick. One of the village corporations in Southeast brought it up to their shareholders, and they voted against it because they were afraid that if it went to fee simple title that it would be bought out because the area has a lot of recreational development potential. But
what village was that?
Yakutat. And the corporation itself was shocked that the shareholders had voted it down.
The shareholders were concerned that the 1.5 acre home sites might be
sold
to non-natives,
yes,
sort of thing?
Yes, there's a lot of recreational development potential there, and that's what they're afraid of, is non-natives coming in and harvesting the resources that they've used subsistently. But our corporation is somewhat sorry that we did do a Anilka distribution, and there are definite advantages to just do a partial liquidation.
What are the advantages that?
It's to the shareholder themselves. Under the Anilka distribution, the lots are valued, I think, at like $50, and so if you sell your lot for the appraised value is about $15,000, I think. If you sell your lot for $15,000, which is probably a minimum price, you have to pay the capital gains income tax, which is substantial. If we had done a partial liquidation, the lots would have been valued at the appraised value, $15,000, and if the shareholder sold the lot, then he would have to pay capital gains on very little. And that was something we had not thought about before, and we had considered going back to the shareholders and saying, well, do you want to change it to just a partial liquidation? But it had taken so long to get to that point that we decided not to.
Well, around the table here, you say there's two in Bristol Bay that have distributed home site lots under Anilka, two villages. Are there any others in Southeast besides Craig? No, Marlene says no.
I know of one in Cook Inlet that has done a partial liquidation of based on.
Which is that?
Salamatoff.
And what is the size of the?
Well, it varies. The basis, they were all appraised, and so the amount of land is given a dollar value, and everybody gets a different amount of land, but all of an equal value. I don't know about Soldovia, but
Yeah. Roland Shanks?
Seldovia had a different kind of program. They used long-term leases. Ninilchik's had a distribution. Fort Yukon has had a home site program. Bethel is ready to get into one. I think Dillingham, didn't Dillingham have some kind of program out there?
Don Nielsen is shaking his head no.
Oh, okay. I thought they had.
Bart?
But there's been villages that have either already undertaken a program like this or are actively pursuing a program like this. I think it's, at least ways the village land managers I talk to, it is a real hot topic every time there's a shareholder meeting. And the pressure is getting greater and greater on not only village but regional corporations to make a distribution of land. I know our corporation has been looking at it, and again, because of the unique status of our corporation, we end up with about a $2.5 million bill to get over the zoning and platting requirements of the municipality of Anchorage, and then we look forward to having to have probably $2 or $3 million in the bank in order to operate our first rights of refusal on any lots that do come up for sale. But there are a lot of villages that are looking into this. It is a very active program.
Bart, then Rosita, and Glenn.
You should look at the underlying reason or why the home site program had to be enacted in the first place also to get an appreciation of the idea. Under ANGSCA, there are 14 C1 reconveyances to people who had houses and places there already. So, I mean, you had conveyances already mandated by ANGSCA. The problem was is that the younger people or some who weren't in the village at the time who hadn't established residences or fish camps or something but who were shareholders couldn't get land out from the corporation in any way other than through a partial liquidation or through some other means that had to have overall shareholder approval. And even if you did that, there would be tax consequences, so that the lands under ANCSIF through 14C1 have are deemed conveyed because they're authorized by ANCSIF. These other ones wouldn't be. So that's part of what the home site was, to be able to authorize the corporations to get lands out to people who hadn't established residences but would, and to have some of these protections.
Well, can I ask a question about that? In the Craig thing, they distributed them to every shareholder because presumably under corporate law, you can't discriminate and give some people lots and refuse to give other people lots, and they had to do it by lottery so that everybody was treated equally. How do you reconcile that with the business of, well, some people already have lots under 14C, others want lots, so the corporation provides them with lots under ANILCA. I'm immersed as we were yesterday in corporate law, I think I remembered enough to ask this question.
Well, Dan Fessler can probably talk to it more generally, but there's a requirement for pro rata distributions. I mean, a shareholder has, when there are distributions made, a general law of corporate law is that you have the right to a pro rata distribution if one is made, unless the shareholders agree otherwise. I mean, but Dan, can you specify on that?
Well, this would be yet another example of the fact that although we have mandated under ANCSA that the corporations be created under Alaska law, the initial requirement that corporations engage in certain distributions was part of the federal law, and the corporations attorned to that. They honored that obligation. It would theoretically offend the common law concept that is enshrined in the bare bones statutory law that Alaska has on corporations. It's clear that under Alaska concepts of corporate obligation that a corporation cannot engage in discriminatory distribution of its assets. In this instance, I don't know whether there's ever been any challenge to the notion that the corporation was engaging under distributions mandated by federal law, but then did not carry out similar distributions that would be theoretically within its discretion. Or indeed, if the corporation had obliged the content of federal law by making a distribution of lands to a certain shareholder because that was the requirement of ANSCA, later on were to come along and make distributions of lands in partial liquidation or treating them in some way as distributions by way of dividends, and then try and exclude from that distribution persons who had previously received land, whether or not that could be challenged on the ground that that would be discriminatory. It's simply about the fourth specific example that we've had, that ANCSA corporations at their birth and under the mandate of federal legislation have been forced to behave in a manner which, were they not ANCSA corporations, would be highly dubious under just general state law corporate concepts.
Yes, Elizabeth?
You know, one of the things is I think is we think conceptually about the 14C required distributions. Those were really not distributions, in a sense, of corporate assets. Under ANCSA, it was decided that people who were there at a certain magic date, be they shareholders or non-shareholders, would be entitled to...
Native or non-native.
Yes, native or non-native, thank you, would be entitled to certain types of lands for certain types of purposes. Primary place of residence is the one that springs to mind, but I know there are others listed under the Act. So, and these were not really, these, if you like, were lands always encumbered by Congress with other people's ownership. The corporation became a vehicle or a conduit, as opposed to the home site situation, where you are dealing with lands that were corporate lands and assets and fall under the concepts that Dan was referring to as the question about per share or per capita, I should say per share type distributions that are tended under corporate law to be equal. And Dolly's group had handled that by the lottery system so that you didn't have valuation questions and that sort of thing.
Rosita.
In the North Slope, there is a community up there that, well, there are a number of communities and corporations that transferred some of their land within the village to the North Slope Borough. And the North Slope Borough then, in turn, built public housing on corporation lands. And they the corporations had to turn their land over to the borough in order for them to utilize HUD money to build the houses. And so then those houses then transferred to both native and non-native. One of the corporations itself also made had a lottery, and the only individuals, the only shareholders who could participate were young adults with children.
Well, maybe I could summarize what I think we have learned in this discussion. That is, Rosita made the point that Native people traditionally had notions of private property, to put it in a rough way, as well as communal property. And it may be that the provisions of ANILCA relating to home sites are a way of reflecting that in the modern world. We're still left, it seems to me, and in all my travels, the only place I've been to, we held a hearing at Klawak, and some people came from Craig and told us about the home site program, but I can't think of any other village where they told us they had distributed the lots. That's why I had thought it was not commonplace. But it may be the 1985 study has actually documented the extent to which this has been done, but it is certainly something that is worth pinning down. Roland, you didn't have anything to add to that, did you?
No, I don't have any firm numbers on how many. I know that, like I say, from attending more meetings than I'd care to admit, it's always a hot topic. It is a topic of discussion that comes up almost immediately when you get more than two land managers together in one room. That is, have you done it? If so, how'd you do it? Are you going to do it? If so, how are you going to do it?
Well,
are the topics.
Maybe that's a point at which to change the subject, because it still leaves us with the question of the broad question of native lands that were traditionally held or thought of as communal lands. And we were talking about nonprofits, cooperatives, and IRAs, and perhaps we could return to those three, because it seems to me that that is what arises out of the AFN resolutions numbers 7 and 8, which we had reached yesterday. And perhaps we could continue with that. My recollection is that the land bank, while protecting native land from taxation, as well as judgments and adverse possession, didn't protect the land from corporate takeover or corporate failure. The it seems to me that after Dan Fessler talked about nonprofits and co-ops, it was clear that if you transferred the land to a nonprofit or a co-op, you at least were protected from corporate failure if your business risk-taking activities were in the original entity and not in the nonprofit or the co-op. And you were protected against corporate takeover and corporate failure. You were not protected against property taxation, as I understand it. But perhaps that's not an accurate summary of what was said, and I think we should go back into that again. Tony, you wanted to start the discussion.
I did want to add one more twist to the this discussion about these alternative structural forms that we were talking about yesterday, and that is a problem that is, or a perceived problem, if nothing else, that's raised by people in, and I've seen it all over the state, and that is the issue of when we have a limited number of people who are being elected to these different positions, and limited number of skills in a given community or within a given region. Oftentimes you have a situation where there's a person who sits on the village corporation board of directors or acts as an officer of the village corporation who also sits on the board of directors for the regional corporation. And that raises a question of, among a lot of the shareholders, that there's a conflict of interest, between the village corporation and the regional corporation, and how do you resolve that conflict? And when we're talking about setting up other forms of land holdings, if we're going to talk about holding land in a cooperative or in a nonprofit, how do you resolve the potentials for conflicts of interest between the landholder and the developing company to when they're making decisions? And I think that's an important twist to the discussion.
Well, could I see if Dan Fessler or Elizabeth Johnson want to add anything to what they said yesterday about nonprofits and cooperatives? The problem that we faced, it seems to me, at the very outset of this 3 days was people in the villages want to protect their land, to pass it on from one generation to another in perpetuity. We talked about the corporate structure. Can it be done in that way? We then moved on to look at the possibility of transferring land to these other entities. And I suggested, I took the liberty of suggesting, that there were three concerns that ought to be considered paramount. One, protection from loss through corporate failure, protection from loss through corporate takeover, and protection from loss through taxation. And no one has argued strenuously with those three criteria.
Which I raised earlier, distributional patterns. That is to say, flexibility in distribution of benefits. A nonprofit has different range of obligations with respect to benefit distribution. But I'd like to ask, will you also ask Dan to revisit the taxation of lands held by nonprofits? I wasn't clear whether it was his view that they're non-taxable.
Right. Revisit taxation of land held by nonprofits. Dan, would you do that?
Sure. It would be my assessment, subject to correction by people who would know something about the peculiarities of Alaska law, that the general concept is that if land is held by a nonprofit and the nonprofit itself does not qualify for exemption from taxation predicated upon some other attribute of the entity, such as it's a religious entity or it is organized for a charitable or eleemosynary purpose, that for what would be the types of things that we're talking about, the land holdings of nonprofit entities are fully exposed to taxation.
The lands of CNIC or Klutna are held for the benefit of a set of beneficiaries. How broad does this set of beneficiaries have to be before it becomes eleemosynary?
Let's define eleemosynary.
Eleemosynary is one of those lovely terms which you always fear when you use it that someone will ask you to spell it, right? The concept of eleemosynary goes back to the corporal works of mercy in Scripture. If the basic purpose of the corporate entity was to minister to the sick, all right, that was an eleemosynary purpose. If it serves as a hospice for the dying, that is an eleemosynary purpose. You immediately get the impression that one of the you don't envision native corporations turning themselves into eleemosynary institutions. If there may be some disagreement here, but I mean, the basic notion, first of all, of taxation of nonprofit entities has come under a great deal of scrutiny. I don't know how many of you may have seen a television program done on 60 Minutes some 4 years ago called Dial M for Money, which indicated how you could get to the American public by saying that something was a nonprofit entity. People immediately acted with a sort of disarmed sense of suspicion. They thought, well, gee, this must be a soft, cuddly type corporation as opposed to one of those ratty corporations that's in the marketplace looking for profit. And a number of people have done very well while giving the impression somehow that they might be trying to do good in the world. And so the notion of what is appropriately organized as a nonprofit entity isn't in itself coming under great scrutiny. Now, the Internal Revenue Service has detailed regulations to ascertain whether or not an entity can, by simply calling itself a nonprofit entity, achieve nonprofits or non-taxable status, or can achieve the status of deductions for people who give money to it. States are increasingly becoming sophisticated in distinguishing between two basic types of nonprofit corporations, what are called mutual benefit nonprofits that are organized for the benefit of their members, and public benefit nonprofits, which have some public function. Normally, charitable entities are conceptualized as belonging as public benefit nonprofits, and then states make determinations as to whether they will extend tax concessions to them predicated upon the functions they're serving in society. Mutual benefit nonprofits in no state which has made these sophisticated judgments are extended any tax benefits at all.
I guess what I wanted to try to tie what the judge has talked about earlier, the communal services or the communal benefits or some of the communal functions.
Communal benefits in this context are meant the entire public at large, well, the community chest.
Yeah, all right, but let's say that you're in Craig, a village, which may have non-native as well as native members. One question one could ask is, could you have a nonprofit designed to benefit all native people living in Nome?
Yes.
And then would it be non-taxable? Could it be charitable? Would the fact that it only benefits native people in Nome preclude it from receiving non-taxable treatment under state law?
That's a public
all right, so then the question is,
I'm not prepared to answer. I don't know what the attitude of the Alaska Department of Commerce would
be. But it's arguable.
No, well, leaving aside the attitude, at law, there's no reason why they would not be taxed. Is that your point?
No reason why they would not be taxed. And obviously, government is increasingly taking the presumption that it bends every doubtful issue of whether you're susceptible of taxation or not in favor of saying that you're susceptible of taxation.
But could I narrow this just slightly?
Yes.
If
What I'm trying to say to you is that, there is no automatic tax exemption garnered either by state or federal law by calling yourself a nonprofit entity.
Right, but if you're not making money, if you don't have something, if you don't earn something that is called a profit, you're not liable to income tax.
You're not liable to income tax, but you can go broke evading income taxes by not having any money. I mean,
but all right, so could we confine ourselves to property tax?
Property tax, right.
Yeah. And property taxes are not a federal issue, and therefore there's no uniformity in American state law.
I guess the question would be, and this is a state law question, and maybe you know me, if Cook Inlet Native Association, which is the nonprofit for the Cook Inlet area, it serves non-Cook Inlet shareholders as well as Cook Inlet shareholders, and a wide variety of social services, owned land in the Cook Inlet, in Cook Inlet or anywhere else, would that be taxable? That's the question I was asking.
And I would not be competent to answer that question.
Maybe David can answer that.
Dolly Garza and then David Case.
It seems like that would be, it would be decided as each corporation chose to do that. And in corporations, say in Nome or Kotzebue, where, you know, in villages 90% of the public, of the community is native, then it may be viewed as a public service and be non-taxable. But in a village, say with Craig, where only 16% of the community is natives, even though that nonprofit may apply for non-taxable status, the non-natives in the area may protest to the state, and the nonprofit in Craig may not be able to obtain that status.
Okay, David Case.
I too am not competent to answer this question, but I do have some knowledge of nonprofit taxation under state law, and I guess probably question, as near as I can tell, hasn't been fully decided. But there are organizations like Cook Inlet Native Association that do public purpose kinds of activities in other cities, and they are arguing now that they are not subject to property tax of that municipality under state law.
Right.
And as far as I can tell, they have a good argument. And of course, the distinction of which I'm aware is that that has to do with Providence Hospital, and I don't think it went off on the Elia Bassanieri grounds, but Providence Hospital is not taxable, it's not subject to property tax.
But it also happens to be held by the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, but the office building that it owns next to Providence Hospital,
who is your mentor in life. You have
does that mean that the office
angel.
Building next to the hospital that is taxable shouldn't be taxable?
If when the legislature was looking into the question of revising the not-for-profit corporation law in Alaska last year, people were startled to find that the most common not-for-profit organizations in this state are tied either overtly or rather tangentially to religious purposes. And there's no question as to why that's being done. You create the presumption of favorable tax treatment under the federal government by saying that you can't define a religion. And you create the more than thin edge of the wedge for favorable treatment under state law, because it is quickly found out that the first time the state challenges one of these nonprofits, all of the others are brought in to protect you on the ground that if anything with a religious overtone is taxed, then God knows what next. They'll be taxing the synagogues and the cathedrals. I mean, that's
right,
been
but
the...
But the
I'd like
building,
to ask...
Well, let David just carry on for a minute.
The building next to the hospital, which is on the hospital grounds and owned by the Sisters of Providence, is taxable.
I'm certain that it is because, again, certain institutions, large institutions, such as the Archdiocese of Anchorage, have for years carefully conceded that they wanted to distinguish between those lands and those assets which were held primarily for religious use and those which were not. And they have allowed, without protest, the imposition of state tax on things which they held that were not being used for religious purposes. But the hospital itself is organized as a nonprofit entity, and it is, you know, not about to lay down its religious affiliation, because that's a very important thing for it.
Yeah. I don't want to make this, belabor this, but the hospital, as I understand it, is not taxable because of its activity But the office building, this is a distinction perhaps only the Alaska Supreme Court can understand, but the office building next to it used for doctor's offices is taxable, is subject to the city property tax.
Yes, okay. And we found that last year that there were individuals who sincerely held the belief that if a church wanted to open a chain of McDonald's franchises, that because any of the proceeds used from the chain of McDonald's franchises would go to the glorification of God's work, as well as the corruption of the digestive systems of people, and therefore speed them on their way to God, that these dual purposes meant that they would be free from taxation.
Caleb Pangawi, who's president of a nonprofit, I'm waiting for you to clear up this question, Caleb.
Okay. I'm going to speak from the point of the city of Nome, which has taken some of the churches to court concerning this law that the state of Alaska has concerning exclusively for charitable, religious, and educational and hospital use. The city has taken a position that the word exclusive strictly means that it is for that specific purpose. If it's going to be for religious purposes, then it should be exclusively used for religious purposes. If it's not for religious purposes, then it should be taxable. That's the way the city of Nome has interpreted the law. It's currently before the Supreme Court of Alaska, and the Supreme Court has not yet ruled on that. And it applies to other nonprofit organizations where the land that is owned by the nonprofits is subject to city tax unless it's used for either one of those, either hospital use or for charitable use. Not just simply because they're nonprofit does not mean that it's a non-taxable asset.
Well, you're head of Kowarik, which is a nonprofit. Does Kowarik own any real property?
Yes, we own some real property in the city of Nome. And the way we have gotten, we have paid our taxes for the first year, but for the next year, we've set aside the land for educational purposes. In that, the building that we built on that land will be for educational purposes, and therefore exempted from property tax.
And it depends not on the fact that it's a nonprofit that owns the land; it's the purpose for which the land is used.
And that is as it ought to be. I mean, in many jurisdictions where they don't want to try and fight these battles, the way you do it is you say that if you can qualify under the federal law so that contributions are tax exempt, then as far as we're concerned, that's the operative determination and we will exempt you from local real estate taxation. In other words, it's very common in the United States for municipal governments that have home rule and therefore their own taxing powers to abrogate this decision. Because it is a hot political question. It is a quintessentially political question.
Okay. Well, I wonder if we could, Marlene Johnson?
The city of Ketchikan took Ketchikan Indian Corporation to court over a piece of land that the Ketchikan Indian Corporation felt they were not taxable on. And the city of Ketchikan won that.
I wonder if we could could do this now. I'd like to ask Ralph Johnson to talk about IRAs. There's a couple of reasons for that. They fit not only into this triumvirate of or these four or five possibilities we have, but I found in the villages that people keep talking about IRAs, and some of you here take a dim view of IRAs, so I think this would be a good opportunity to kick them around and see how they how they take it. Just before we do
I am most anxious to have the contribution I'd like to make after Ralph's, but I would like at some point, if it becomes convenient, to recur to the topic of cooperatives, because I felt that yesterday we went over them relatively rapidly. They are
let's deal
matters
with them now.
Of potentially significant interest, and there is also an opportunity, a political window right now, in that the cooperative statute is under review by the body which the legislature charges with looking at them. And so if there is a constituency of potential users of the statute, now is an appropriate time to alert everybody to that fact, so that you can be in on the ground floor of taking a look at the cooperative statute, understanding what existing law looks like, what its perceived strengths and weaknesses are, and what the opportunities are to change it.
Excuse me, Dan. I think we should do that now, because cooperatives seem to me to follow logically from nonprofits, and you're the expert on this. So,
well,
if that's all right with you, Ralph.
Sure.
Is it all right with you, Tony?
If we could do it.
Absolutely all right. What I'd still like to have Professor.
Is this
Fessler,
conflict of interest
this
problem?
This conflict of interest thing. Yes.
And so at some point when you decide that that's germane, I think we should have that conversation too.
Okay.
But yesterday we talked about nonprofits, and we saw that nonprofits themselves are sort of a house divided. There are two types of entities that are organized as nonprofits. They have certain attractive features because, to a greater extent than profit-seeking corporations, there is historical experience with restricting entry by defining the qualifications of members. There is also they are less subject to takeover in the sense that some states, but unfortunately not Alaska, provide by statute that nonprofits can only merge with or consolidate with other nonprofit entities. Right? And if that happened to be the reformed content of Alaska law, then any candidate to take over the corporation would have to also be a nonprofit entity. And so you can see that certain suitors in the marketplace are disqualified. The biggest problem with nonprofits is this, what Monroe alluded to. Their essence is that they cannot make distributions to members, so that there cannot be, quote, dividends. The way in which a member got a benefit out of associating with a nonprofit was receiving the services which the nonprofit provided. And theoretically, they would be provided at a cost which would be less than if you had to buy it from a profit-seeking corporation, on the theory that the profit-seeking corporation has as an element of its cost structure that